This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. More than half of adults in the United States are considered obese or overweight, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The agency says obesity is a serious concern because of its health and its economic impact. As the obesity epidemic continues to capture national attention, it puts the lives and habits of obese people into the spotlight. And some argue that this hyperfocus has some downsides, like fat discrimination and stigma. Regan Chastain is a writer who's dedicated her career to fat activism. She blogs at danceswithfat.org, and she's also authored the book Fat, The Owner's Manual, Navigating a Thin, Obsessed World with Your Health, Happiness, and Sense of Humor Intact. Regan, welcome to The State of Things.
Thanks for having me. I'm super excited.
Wonderful. So I know the term body positivity has become more popular in American lexicon. That's a little bit different from what you call fat activism. Tell me, what exactly is fat activism?
So fat activism is the idea that fat people have the right to exist in fat bodies. And it doesn't matter why we're fat or what the quote unquote consequences of being fat might be. We have the right to exist without shame, stigma, bullying, or oppression.
And you claim the term fat actively. Tell me about why you choose to claim that term.
I do. So first of all, it's a perfectly good adjective that other people have been allowed to sort of heap negative connotations on. And so I want my adjective back. And it doesn't pathologize my body the way that other terms do. So like, you know, overweight, for example, like I'm short, I'm not medically under tall. And so by the same logic, I'm fat, I'm not over some, you know, non-existent weight that I'm not. And it's kind of just a way that I let my bullies know that they can't have my lunch money anymore. So it's a reclaiming term for me as well.
And how did this reclamation, how did you come to this point in your journey? What is the history of your relationship with your body that's led to this work as a fat activist?
Well, I was always bigger, but I was also a successful athlete growing up. And so I didn't have a lot of body shaming. And then like my junior year of high school, my friend's mom told me, you know, you're going to lose that weight before college, right? Like you don't want to go to college fat, do you? And that started sort of my first serious diet that spiraled all the way into an eating disorder. And so in recovering from the eating disorder, I was still considered like too heavy. And so I was being treated for eating disorder, but simultaneously doctors were telling me to lose weight and prescribing all these different diets. And I was having the same response that I later learned almost everyone does, which is I would lose weight short term and then I'd gain it back long term no matter what I did, often gaining back more than I had lost. And so finally, I was doing this incredibly strict medically supervised program, but I was still gaining weight. And so I told them I wanted to quit. And they said, oh, well, you know, you can't quit. And I was like, no, I'm pretty sure I can. And so they put me in this little room with a woman who was flipping through this binder of pictures of fat women. And she said, maybe you don't know it, but this is what you look like. And these women are going to die alone on the couch eating bonbons. And is that what you want for your life? And aren't you tired of hating your body? And so that was like a really pivotal moment because first of all, I was like, that's what I look like. Like, I thought I looked so much, you know, quote unquote, worse than those women. And so it was the first inkling that I had that I didn't hate their body. So why did I hate mine so much? And I grew up in rural America on cattle ranches. So I didn't know what a bonbon was. That went over my head completely. But I was like, God, yeah, I am tired of hating my body. Like, I'm exhausted from hating. I had been hating my body like it was a job. Like, I was getting paid to do it. And it hadn't made me any healthier or thinner or happier. It just made me miserable. And so at that point, I decided I was going to separate the two and I was going to learn to love my body. And then I was going to, you know, figure out how to get healthy. And so that was when I started sort of down the path of figuring out like my body does all of these amazing things for me. And I hadn't had a second's worth of gratitude for any of that because I was too busy complaining that it didn't fit to some stereotype of beauty that I had been sort of force fed practically since birth in this culture.
Well, so you laid out.
And so that was. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say you laid out pretty clearly sort of what it felt like to watch someone flip through those images. Are there things that you have experienced that you think sort of reflect a more systemic discrimination that fat people face in society?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so everything from street harassment. For example, when I was training for my first marathon, some guys threw eggs at me from a car. So that's, you know, pretty good. You know, example of where our culture is with fat people. And then just trying to get competent medical care as a fat person. I had run 18 miles the day before and I had a doctor tell me, you know, you've really got to start and it's going to be hard, but if you can do it, it'll change your whole life. I just need you to walk 10 minutes a day. And so, you know, and that doctor, by the way, hadn't had the proper size blood pressure cuff, so he couldn't get a correct blood pressure on me. He then guessed that I was inactive based on my size, just making wild guesses. And that's pretty common as well. And then, you know, in hiring, I've been self-employed for a really long time. So, and I do this work full time as a speaker and writer. So I get less of that because people know what they're getting. But I mean, in a study that was done for the Journal of Applied Psychology, they found that fat women were paid on average $19,000 per year less than thinner women. And in a study of 500 hiring managers who were shown a picture of a fat woman, 15.9% said that they would consider hiring her. The rest said that they would not. And over 20% said that she was lazy and unprofessional based on her picture. So, I mean, this discrimination is real. It's happening all the time.
I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now, Penny Gordon Larson. She is a professor and associate chair for research in nutrition at the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. She's also an obesity expert. Penny, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Anita.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about sort of what Reagan was alluding to, that fat discrimination and fat stigma is a really prevalent problem. Do you consider fat stigma a public health issue?
Absolutely. And I think that Reagan illustrated a number of situations that are, you know, just unconscionable. And I think one of the biggest issues we face is in healthcare, with a majority of healthcare providers not trained adequately to deal with obese patients and obese people. And that results a lot of times in that same kind of bias or discrimination that Reagan just told a story about. And there's an actual certification program. There's a specialty in obesity medicine that physicians can get trained in, and then they learn about why obesity is so complex and why you can't look at somebody and say, oh, well, that person must be engaging in poor health habits, because size and health habits don't necessarily go hand in hand. You can have a healthy lifestyle at any size. And so that kind of care that really flies in the face of actually making a positive change.
So maybe you can't look at someone and know what their health is, but think about a common scenario. You walk into the doctor's office, you get on a scale, the scale reads a certain number, and then the doctor says, okay, you are overweight, you are obese, and this is what I encourage you to do. What do you see as the problem with that scenario?
So the problem with that scenario is usually the message that they're going to give to the individual is eat less, move more. And for most people, it's a lot more complicated than just eating less and moving more. So there's a range of behaviors and physiological responses that are very complicated. And, you know, there's a lot of information that needs to be gleaned about health habits overall. So not just diet and exercise, but also sleep and stress and other factors that play a role. Also, the medications that people are taking, which can really do a lot of weight gain, contribute a lot of weight gain to, you know, to somebody as well. So there's an estimate that weight gain is associated, about 10% of obesity is associated with taking, you know, various medications that have that side effect. So, you know, there's a lot of detail that should be gotten from somebody before you just jump to a conclusion that they're not exercising or not eating well.
So obesity is incredibly complicated, multifactorial. As you mentioned, we associate BMI with obesity. Can you tell me about that link and maybe why BMI might be a more outdated way to think about fat and obesity?
Well, I think BMI is a very good measure, and in for the majority of people, BMI works great. But what BMI doesn't do is it doesn't tell you about the diet and exercise habits of the individual, because as Reagan just said, you know, she just ran a marathon and had a provider tell her that she needed to start an exercise program. So you can't assume that somebody's behavior is, you know, just by looking at them. You have to find out all of those details. It takes a lot of time and effort to collect that kind of information.
So Reagan, tell me about your experience going in to the doctor and getting this kind of messaging that you need to eat less and move more. You say that focusing on weight loss is a problem with this movement. Tell me.
Oh, it's a huge problem. So my my focus of study in school was research methods and statistical analysis. And so when I decided I wanted to figure out how to get healthy, I also decided I was going to find the best diet, the one that worked the most. And so I did a literature review of all of the literature I could find about weight loss. And what I found was that there's not a single study of any method where more than a tiny fraction of people succeed long term. And when they say success, often they mean less than 10 pounds over a 5-year period. And so what happens is we're fooled because most people are able to lose weight short term, but then almost everyone gains it back. And so since a majority of the research is funded by diet companies, they simply stop the study at 1 or 2 years when people have gained back some weight, but not all of it, and they claim success. In fact, the FTC, when it had hearings, told Weight Watchers that they wanted them to do longer term studies, and Weight Watchers told them, and I quote, "It would be too depressing for our clients." And so there's a huge issue within the research around weight loss, and then there's a huge issue within the application. So what happens is about 95% of people gain their weight back. 2/3 of those gain back more than they lost. So even if we believe that body size is a problem, to prescribe weight loss is statistically the worst advice we could give people based on everything that we know. And so when I go to the doctor and they try to prescribe weight loss, my first question is, based on what? Like, do you believe that weight loss meets the criteria of evidence-based medicine? And if they say yes, then I say, well, can you show me a study where this worked for even a majority of people? And again, these people are losing 10 pounds. They're wanting me to lose a tremendous amount more than that. And so I think it's a huge issue of just basic competent evidence-based medicine.
Penny, what's your take on the diet studies that are out there?
So before I get to the diet studies, one thing that's important to consider is the fact that even 5% of weight loss in an obese person can bring about clinically meaningful change. So it's important to consider that. And that's really what's important to think about, is what is the clinically meaningful impact of the weight loss as opposed to cosmetic. But the data on weight loss and diets is very complicated. So for most people, when you look at these studies that are published, they're publishing the average effect. The average effect may be, as Reagan describes, not that big in terms of successful weight loss. But if you look at the tails of the distribution, you find that some people, you can even take identical groups of people, put them on the same exact calorie and exercise program, and they will have differential weight gain or weight loss. So some people, you put them actually on what you think is a weight loss program, and they gain weight. Some people, you put them on that program, same exact program, and they actually, it's incredibly successful for them, and they lose a lot of weight on it. And then for the majority of people, they're somewhere in the middle. So there's a lot of variation in who's susceptible to what kinds of changes. And what we are ideally trying to do is tailor the kind of program that works the best for the person. The person has to like it. They have to adhere to the program, but it has to work for them. And so often it takes a lot of trial to figure out what works best for any given individual.
So, Reagan, some may hear what you're saying, that, you know, focusing on weight loss is not where we should focus, as you promoting the idea that being obese is okay or being obese is healthy. Can you talk about your response to that? I know that's a common criticism of the fat activism movement.
Sure. First of all, being fat is fine. There's nothing wrong with being fat regardless. You're allowed to live a full and amazing and happy life regardless of your body size, your health, your ability. I want to go back and address that 5% weight loss comment, because that number does not come from clinical trials. Mann and Tomiyama addressed this in their 2013 study in the articles they wrote about it, that it started out with the Metropolitan Insurance Company's ideas of the healthy weight and height, and they were very specific. But doctors weren't able to get people to lose that kind of weight. So then they went to 20% and said that made a clinically meaningful difference. But doctors weren't able to get people to lose that amount of weight. So they went to 10% and now 5%. The IDEA study, which is one of the largest studies that looked at that kind of weight loss, was not able to achieve 5% and was canceled for futility because it did not have those clinically meaningful results that people were hoping for. Beyond which, when we're talking about weight loss, what happens is people change their habits and they at least temporarily lose weight and they experience health benefits. And for some reason, we want to credit the weight loss with the health benefits rather than the activity changes, despite the fact that studies like Wei et al., Matheson et al., the Cooper Institute longitudinal studies all show that regardless of weight, habit changes are a better predictor of future health and body size. So I want to be really clear about that. It's not clear that the weight loss is what is creating any kind of clinical a health benefit. And there still is no study where the majority, even close to the majority of people, maintain that weight loss over 5 years. So that's important. So in terms of saying that we should focus on our health, and by the way, that's an incredibly personal thing. Health is not an obligation. It's not a barometer of worthiness. It's not entirely within our control. And I know it's not an obligation because I watched the Olympics and there's a sport called skeleton where people go 80 miles an hour down an ice chute face first. This does not prioritize the health. But they're allowed to do it.
Right.
Right. So we're allowed to do whatever we want with our bodies. They're our bodies. And we don't owe anybody else health or healthy behaviors by any definition. But this idea that if we have fat people out there succeeding at something other than weight loss or being happy in their bodies without trying to manipulate their size, that that's somehow promoting obesity is actually ridiculous. People are the size that they are. And the idea that we say, you know, determine how you want to prioritize your health and how you want to get there. And it's okay if you do that at the body size that you are now. And it's okay if you love that body. Loving your body, never being an obligation, but always being an option, is so incredibly important. Because what happens is fat people get the message constantly that we aren't healthy or happy or successful until we will never be those things until we become thinner. And fat people internalize that. They've, you know, this culture, the government's war on obesity, obesity medicine specialists have done a great job of teaching fat people that we are unworthy of care. And fat people believe that. And so we don't seek out care. And when we do, of course, we have a much harder time because of the medical fat phobia that we experience.
And we know, I'm going to pause you for a second.
Sure.
Because I want to give Penny a chance to respond before we have to go to a break. I mean, I think you both are on the same page about the problem with weight stigma. Maybe where you disagree is how health and obesity should be negotiated between a provider and an individual and how that conversation about health should go. Penny, I'm just going to give you a chance to quickly respond and then we'll continue the conversation in a minute.
I think there are plenty of success stories. And there's a really wonderful resource, the National Weight Control Registry. It's a registry of over 10,000 people who have maintained at least 30 pounds over 1 year of weight loss. And those individuals are successful weight losers. They've been very successful at weight loss. And among those individuals, they the trademarks of what they do really are 1 hour of exercise a day. They modify their diets and they do weekly or daily weighing. And those kinds of healthy habits are, you know, again, I agree with Reagan, those are the things we should focus on. But there, you know, there are lots of success stories out there about people who have been able to successfully manage their weight.
But I guess what we do know, and I only have about a minute for this answer, is that your body does fight to gain back.
Oh, weight. Absolutely.
And it is extremely correct. Hard. Can you just talk about that briefly?
Yes. So the there are lots of physiological responses that your body will defend and try to return back to that original weight. And that's something that is physiological, but also sends messages to you that you are hungry and you want to eat. So it's not just involuntary, it's also voluntary messages that are happening between your brain and your gut in very complex physiological system. And that's what causes individuals to regain that weight. So that is a phenomenon we see across the board with weight loss. And so that's why you have to be, you know, careful and aware. And it's not just a matter of losing weight and then stopping the behaviors, that it's really a lifelong behavior change that you would be making to if you are interested in losing weight and maintaining weight.
So your body is fighting against you. The bigger culture is too. And we are going to talk about that in a minute when we return. I'm here with Reagan Chastain, fat activist and blogger and the author of Fat, the Owner's Manual, Navigating a Thin, Obsessed World with Your Health, Happiness, and Sense of Humor Intact. Penny Gordon-Larson, a professor and associate chair for research and nutrition at the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. There's more on the state of things just ahead. Please stay with us. This is A State of Things. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. More than 90 million American adults are obese.
Research shows that excess weight can increase your risk of certain health conditions, but being overweight affects far more than just your health. Studies show obese people have a harder time finding a job and are paid less than thinner people. Today, we're talking about obesity and fat rights. My guests are Reagan Chastain and Penny Gordon Larson. Reagan is a fat activist blogger who blogs at danceswithfat.org. Penny is a professor and associate chair for research and nutrition at the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. So we ended our last segment talking about how your body is fighting back against you. Penny, I want to sort of talk about how obesity often gets framed as a crisis of personal choice. And that can be really problematic for a number of reasons. You have looked at how the societal forces around us impact obesity levels. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so our whole system around us has changed dramatically in the past, you know, several decades. And so we have these labor-saving devices. We have access to enormous, highly palatable and energy-dense foods. We have it's a difficult in our kind of environment to be physically active. There's lots of challenges. So it's actually really, really hard to maintain your weight in our given environment. And that's makes it very, very difficult. There's also, as I mentioned before, there are other kinds of environmental factors. There's environmental pollutants. There are drugs, regular drugs that people take, medications that have side effects for weight gain. There's just a number of different avenues to lead to obesity. And the environmental pressures really, really work against us in trying to maintain a healthy weight in this environment.
And Reagan alluded to earlier the idea that stigma against people who are overweight and them then not wanting to return to the doctor can actually perpetuate the problem. Is there research to back that up?
Yes, that's a terrible problem. And it's a really it's a big problem if individuals not just don't return to the clinic to talk about their weight, but they don't return to the clinic, period. So, you know, not even for screenings or regular health care. And that's awful. It's an issue in gyms if the equipment isn't appropriate, or in athletic wear if you can't buy the right clothes, or, you know, there's just difficult across the board, all of those forces, plus as Reagan mentioned, bias. And, you know, she's experienced people making fun of her while she was exercising. And that kind of environment and social forces also make it incredibly difficult.
Reagan, tell me a bit about what you see as the relationship between fat phobia and capitalism, the system that we're living in that puts pressure on us to look a particular way, to act a particular way, to eat particular foods. Where do you see it from where you stand?
Sure. Well, fat phobia is incredibly lucrative. I mean, from diet companies making more and more, they're up to over $60 billion a year, up from $20 billion a year like 5 years ago. So if their products worked, they wouldn't keep making more money. And then because fat bodies are seen as inherently riskable, we've got riskier and riskier treatments, from drugs to stomach amputation surgeries, that are incredibly expensive, incredibly lucrative for the people doing them, and sometimes deadly for the fat people who are getting involved. And so you've got this idea that if we can, you know, we've got, you know, this proportion of people who are fat, which, by the way, changed in 1998. They changed what consisted of an overweight BMI. And so about 25 million Americans became, quote unquote, overweight overnight. And so they've also increased the market over time. Lobbying companies for lap band and stomach amputation surgeries, which are very powerful, have been successful in continuously lowering both the weight and the age at which these dangerous procedures are considered acceptable. And so we see fat people as a giant profitability center. They have full conferences on how to profit from the eradication of fat people as a supposed health intervention.
So fat bodies are sort of caught in the crosshairs between a number of different institutions and factors. And what we were sort of talking with Penny about, this idea that having excess weight is a moral failing and losing weight is simply a matter of willpower. How do you navigate that in terms of your work and your conversations with people?
I look at it from starting from a basis of the fact that everybody has the right to exist regardless of their size or their health. So that's the first most important thing. Regardless of what the evidence says about fat and health, fat people have the right to exist. But when I start looking at the evidence, you start seeing how embarrassingly poor. The research is, for example, the National Weight Control Registry. Since 1994, they have 10,000 successes. That's out of an estimated over 1 billion weight loss attempts. That's lottery odds. But we're still using that to say, see, fat people can lose weight. They're not asking those billion people if they made the same behavioral changes as the people who lost weight, which they very well may have, but not been successful. So what the National Weight Control Registry does is just look for commonalities among outliers. So it'd be like interviewing people who survived a skydiving accident to see, like, well, if they all wore a green shirt, maybe we should all do that and then skydive without a chute.
So it seems like this idea of decoupling fat and fit is something that you are really engaged with. I wonder, Penny, from your perspective, do you think those two terms can be decoupled?
Well, I think exercise and exercise habits are critical at any size. And so it's just important to focus on increasing healthy behaviors. And that's a big, you know, of course, a big issue. Most people are not physically active at the level that they should be.
Is this an American problem?
No, it's a problem across the world. Obesity has increased across the world, and exercise, just as America has become more difficult to be physically active in terms of perhaps crime and other areas, access to healthy food, access to processed and energy-dense food, barriers to being physically active in the environment, all of those are factors that we see around the world.
So when we think about potential paradigm shifts, I know that, Reagan, you are in support of this idea of health at every size. Can you just explain sort of briefly what the principles of that are?
Sure. So health at every size says, again, that health is not an obligation, barometer of worthiness, or entirely within our control. It says that from a public health perspective, from a healthcare perspective, and from a personal choice perspective, healthy behaviors are in our control, unlike weight loss, and are a better predictor of future health than body size. And also that we have to look at social determinants of health. If you look at, for example, Peter Munig's research out of Columbia, he found that constant social stigma is correlated with the exact same health conditions to which being fat is correlated. So we have to look at the ways that racism, homophobia, transphobia, Islamophobia, classism, ageism, healthism, ableism, and more, misogyny, all affect people's health on a negative, in a negative way. And we have to look at making that, eradicating that kind of oppression part of public health, rather than trying to make the individual's health the public's business, which is what's happening now, especially with fat phobia.
What do you think about the health at every size paradigm, Penny? Do you think it would be a positive shift to move in that direction?
I personally don't. I think that the wealth of scientific evidence suggests that for most people, that excess weight is detrimental to health. And so it's critical for public health, for reducing healthcare costs, for reducing disability, that we do pay attention to those individuals who might be at a higher body weight, who might have, they might be suffering. So if somebody is carrying excess weight and they're able to be physically active, that's definitely absolutely much better than them not being physically active. And engaging in all of the healthy behaviors at any size is really what I think is critical. I think it's also critical to think about the person and where they are in their life and when they became obese, because we know that there's critical points at the life cycle when you develop obesity. How long have you been obese? That you may be healthy at the moment, but you may wind up, you know, having adverse effects later down the road. We do know that obesity affects every organ system. And so, you know, it's just critical, I think, to consider the health. But again, I think that's separate from the bias and the discrimination and the habits, that those are two separate issues, that you can focus on weight loss, weight management, and effective treatment and advocating for behaviors very separately from dealing with the weight bias. We need to do all of it, but I think that those are very critical and important issues both.
Reagan, I know that you have recently run two marathons. You clearly are sort of a living example of self-identifying as fat and fit. Can you talk about your own personal story sort of within that context?
Sure. I've always been an athlete. I did fast twitch sports growing up. I was a champion ballroom dancer in my late 20s and early 30s, and I decided I wanted to step outside of my comfort zone and do something that I wasn't good at and didn't enjoy, and that's how I ended up doing marathons and training for an Ironman. But at every stage, I had to face people who told me that the only way to improve my skills or my performance would be to manipulate my body size. And they generally suggested that I do that by doing the things I was already doing. I mean, I'm also an example of what the majority of people who attempt intentional weight loss, the vast majority experience, which is that, you know, I was able to lose weight short term and then I would gain it all back and often gain back more than I lost, regardless of what habits I was doing. This myth that it's that people aren't able to maintain these habits. What they mean is people aren't able to continue to starve their body and feed it less food than it needs to survive in the hopes that it will eat itself and become smaller over the long term, which isn't really surprising. So as an athlete, I've had to overcome all of that diet talk and weight loss talk in order to pursue what I wanted to do with my body. And some stuff my body can do well and some stuff it can't do well, but that's everybody. And so learning to love the body I have and, you know, the things that it can do and be in acceptance of the things that it can't has been a big part of that journey as well.
I wonder about this idea of body acceptance, Penny, and that some people think body acceptance itself could be problematic because it could lead us down a path where we're accepting bodies that are going to cost our healthcare system X amount of money, for example. How do we encourage people to feel comfortable, feel safe in the skin that they're in, and also think about this broader context of a society and an environment that we would want to promote moving forward?
Yeah, it's difficult because it's so pervasive and it's so the societal pressures to be thin are really there. And it starts young and kids are made fun of. And I think the more role models and the more we see obese people out exercising, eating healthy, the more people can understand that you can engage in those behaviors, and that's going to be beneficial for everyone, regardless of size. So that I think is really, really critical and really important. The more physicians and healthcare providers we get trained in adequately supporting the weight loss journeys of individuals across a variety of sizes, the better off we'll be. It doesn't help anything whether you're trying to get somebody to lose weight, maintain weight, or ignore their weight. It doesn't help anything to not give them the tools to feel positively about their bodies and their body's capabilities to be healthy.
And it seems to me, Reagan, I mean, you have had such visceral responses to your work. There's an entire Reddit sub thread devoted to people who hate you, basically. And I wonder why you think people have such strong feelings about the choices that you make about your own body.
They are my special snowflakes. So I want to first be clear that there's a thing in fat activism we call the good fatty, bad fatty dichotomy, the idea that some fat people are okay if they do the quote unquote healthy habits and others deserve to be judged or treated poorly because they don't. And that's crap and that needs to stop. And so I want to be clear. If I'm an inspiration for people who want to get involved in physical activity, that's great. But I am in no way saying that what I'm doing is the right way to be fat. And I also want to be clear that running a marathon and having a Netflix marathon are morally equivalent activities, like both completely reasonable ways to spend a Sunday. In terms of why people hate me, I think that because our society focuses so much on the thin ideal, there's a large group of people who have made their self-esteem contingent on the fact that they are better than fat people. So when someone like me comes along and says, no, I don't value that system at all. Your body's great, but no better than my body. That's a big challenge to everything that they've based their self-esteem on. And then I think there are people on the internet who are just jerks, and fat people make an easy target. We are not by any stretch the last acceptable prejudice. I mean, Black kids are being shot in the street. Brown kids are being ripped from their parents. Trans people can't use the restroom. There's a tremendous amount of oppression. So there's no evidence that fat people are the last acceptable prejudice, but it is an acceptable prejudice and it's an easy one because it's all over. It's government funded with a war on obesity. And so I think that that has a lot to do with it as well.
Penny, I wonder what you would say to someone listening to this conversation who may say, I am obese, I am overweight, and I've never been able to safely or comfortably have a conversation about it with a medical provider or with someone who could talk to me about it from a place that is not going to include a lot of shame and discrimination. What advice would you give them?
I would say they need to find the provider who they can feel comfortable talking with. And I think there are more and more providers who are gaining skills in how best to handle obesity management in a clinical setting, and particularly those who are trained properly in obesity medicine. And it's getting to be better and better, but, you know, it is a challenge. And I hope that adequate resources are out there for individuals who do want to have those conversations to be able to. We've had enormous success, I think, and I feel very positively about the direction that we're going in obesity science and the treatments and combinations of treatments and individualized and personalized care that is on, you know, on the horizon, as well as anti-obesity medication. So I think there's a lot of options out there.
Reagan, how about you? What would you say to someone?
I would say find a doctor who practices from a health at every size perspective. And there's a list you can go to. If you Google cat, dragon, fat-friendly doctors, you'll find a list that's worldwide. And if you know a Hays-based doctor, please put them on there. Do not go to a doctor who says they specialize in obesity medicine if you want someone who practices from a health at every size perspective, if you want someone who will not attempt to manipulate your body size as a way to try to get you to greater health, who will not suggest dangerous drugs and surgeries that would not be suggested to thin people who have the same health issue that you do. Find a health at every size practitioner and work with that person, and, you know, work with your own body.
Thank you both so much for joining us, and we will have access to resources, a variety of kinds of resources from both of you at our website, stateofthings.org. Reagan Chastain is a fat activist blogger who blogs at danceswithfat.org. She's also the author of Fat, The Owner's Manual, Navigating a Thin Obsessed World with Your Health, Happiness, and Sense of Humor Intact. Penny Gordon Larson is a professor and associate chair for research and nutrition at the UNC Gilling School of Global Public Health. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You can find out more about their work and all of the resources we talked about today at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is the technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.